Bookend your day with Essential Listening. Breakfast and drive from 6am and PM on RN.
Hello, I'm Michael Cathcart and you're so very welcome to Books and Arts Daily here on RN. A fabulous program today, chock-a-block with marvellous and talented Aussies. Later in the show, the art historians Patrick McCackie and Barry Pearce join us to talk about the great Australian paintings which tell us who we are. And playwright Joanna Murray-Smith will be in. She had a triumphant opening in Melbourne last night. I was there. And this is on top of her hit play now running in Sydney. So you'll hear what she's been up to. But we start the hour with a Radio National favourite, Robert Desay. Yes, the theme music for Books and Writing, which was hosted for a whole decade, last century, I have to say, by my first guest this morning, Robert.
Have to say that.
I'm so sorry. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
You know, I love coming into this studio. Studio 306, we're in Melbourne this morning. And some great broadcasters have sat at this microphone. Terry Lane made the national interest here. Jill Kitson, Julie Copeland, Ramona made the book show from here. And every Sunday you came in here. You did it from Sydney originally, didn't you?
At first, yes.
And then you came in here for the last 5 years, was it?
Yes, I moved to Melbourne halfway through my stint. Well, I do talk actually in the book about Darlinghurst and how I used to go off on Sunday nights and put the program to air in Darlinghurst because I could see it through the hospital window. I could see where I used to be.
So let's explain what this is, why you've come in. So you've written a book called What Days Are For, and it's a memoir. It's a kind of memoir that drifts into essays, and it starts with you falling in the gutter.
Well, it was on the pavement. I wish you wouldn't say gutter. It was on the pavement, really. I keep having to change the publicity for this book.
Right.
It wasn't the gutter.
There was no gutter involved.
There was no gutter involved. It was the pavement. Mm. Yes, I had a heart attack. Mm. And then in the ambulance, I died, and they brought me back. They paddled me back, and then I died again, and they paddled me back again.
Does that mean they did the stand clear thing we see on the telly?
That's right.
Oh, my Lord.
That's what they did. So back I came, and here I am, Michael.
You were jolted back to life.
I was.
Right. And you travelled from Hobart. You live in Hobart with your partner, Peter Timms, your partner of many, many years, to see rehearsals of a play called A Mad Affair.
That's right, I'd written, yes, at NIDA. I mean, it was a reading. It wasn't anything very grand. It wasn't Joanna Murray-Smith, really. But it was exciting for me. And I suppose that's the through line of the book. Am I going to get to see this play or not? Mm. Am I going to die before it goes on?
Yeah. You laugh now.
I laugh now. Or am I going to be just lying here unable to go and see it?
Yeah.
And whether or not I see it is, I suppose, something you'll have to find out by reading the book. But yes, that's the through line. And while following the through line, I recollect, it's not a memoir really, it's a series of recollections.
Yeah.
I mean, you're quite right, it's not really a memoir. I recollect, all sorts of things that have happened just outside the window of that hospital, 10 floors down.
So while the people you love are sitting around you and you're lying there not very coherent, your brain is racing.
I think I thought very clearly. Mm. Yes, I thought in brilliant Technicolor and CinemaScope and very clearly about all sorts of things. They rose up to the surface, perhaps slightly incoherently sometimes, and I tried to capture that in the book, which was quite difficult, that sense of incoherence, but coherently enough for the reader to enjoy what I'm writing.
Well, you've really pulled that off because we really feel as though we're inside your marvellously alert, always discerning, always discriminating mind, while your body's lying there, a bit iffy on the
bed. Very iffy, yes. And all I really wanted to do was turn over. You know, you can't turn over for about 4 days.
Yeah. Oh, shocking.
I thought I'd give anything to turn over and have a chocolate milkshake.
Now, people who know and have loved your work over many years will know that among many of your accomplishments is Russian. You speak Russian. In fact, you taught Russian. You've translated Russian. And you do think about Russian briefly. It comes back to you in the hospital. You end up speaking Russian in hospital, actually. Perhaps you could just read a little bit so the listener gets a sense of how this all works.
Very happily. This is Wednesday, so it's about the third day that I've been there. I'm almost never alone in this white room except at night. And even at night, there's Larissa. She's indeed Russian, it turns out, just as I thought, this nurse who declared she wasn't Polish. And her name is Larissa, from Odessa, another satisfying swipe at randomness. Odessa figures quite prominently in this play of mine, set as it is in Russia. Odessa isn't in Russia, strictly speaking, but it might as well be. Not that I'm Russian, I hasten to add, any more than a man is his wife. More Russian than Chinese, that goes without saying. Nobody could be less Chinese than I am, but not at all Russian. Yet I love my idea of Russia, not the real Russia. The small pocket of Russia, still faintly smelling of Tsars and Turgenev, that I got to know when I was very young. And I also love every syllable, every phoneme in the overflowing treasure house that is the Russian language. I love its tumult and its order, its play with infinite disguises, the theatre of it, the whip-cracking, three-ringed circusness of it, its balletic perfection and peacock elegance, alongside its earthiness, its sibilance, its oohs and ahs and cascades of syllables. How sad I feel when I admit to myself, as I must if I'm honest, that I will never know it as I'd like to. I'll never know it, for all my love of it, as intimately as even some 10-year-old street kid in Vladivostok knows it. Yet it's woven into my soul. It's the weft to the warp I was born with. Since we're talking about Russian, I'll permit myself soul. I started weaving it in as a small boy. My first two Russian words, as it happens, were botanicheski sad, botanical garden, which I had found on a Soviet stamp in my shoebox of foreign stamps. And even now, a whole lifetime later, I'm still weaving, very slowly now and not so deftly, but I come back to the loom from time to time. All the same, I'm not in the slightest bit Russian. Well, possibly just a touch in my aesthetic responses, but that's the limit of it.
Robert Desai, reading from his memoir. It's kind of a memoir, and it's called Night Letters, and you're with him here on Books and Arts Daily on RN this Friday morning. So there you are in hospital, maybe going to die. You were diagnosed with HIV in 1994, 21 years ago. So I guess you've been thinking about death a bit over these years. Or did you just put it behind you and get on with living?
Well, you see, I would try to put it differently if I could. I would try to say I don't think about death so much. I try to think about how you can live well, given that you're not going to live forever. That's really what I do. If you say I think about death, it sounds as if I'm a contemplative of some kind. I'm not sure that I am, really. I want to know how to live well. I want to know what it means to have a good life. And now that I'm not young anymore, and particularly after what happened to me in the hospital, I want to know how to be old in a good way. Because I don't think we talk about it very much in our sort of society. Perhaps they do in some societies, but I'm not sure that we do. If you look at pensioners' newsletters and so forth, they've got hysterically happy couples on the front cover playing golf, smiling, laughing. They're having the time of their lives. It's not like that, I'm here to tell you. Mm. Not really. I think that we're still perhaps deluding ourselves about what it's really like. But I'd like to know how to do it well, and I'm not sure I know the answers yet. But I'm trying.
Well, one of the qualities that comes through in this book is that you have remained critically engaged with the big questions about life, the things that have always motivated you, you know, the sort of why are we here, how should we live. And given that I don't accept religion, you say, how can I express some kind of spiritual dimension? And even that little bit you read, you know, the word soul is there and you kind of apologise for using it, but then you go on. And that's a move you make several times in the book. Spiritual there, I've said it again. You love interjecting on yourself. It's one of your markers. So this spiritual quest, if that's what it is.
Is it what well, it is? You see, it's so hard to find an alternative word in English. I mean, in any language, probably. I want to know how it feels to be somebody who would like to transcend what they see and hear and smell, but doesn't know how to do it. What most people do in order to transcend, in order to prove to themselves that the universe isn't everything, is turn to a religion. And I try to make a distinction between religion, which I see as spirituality gone rotten, and transcendent thinking.
Mm.
It's very difficult to do. Perhaps it's a lost cause and perhaps I should give up. But it gives a certain, well, weight and colouring to my life, so I keep doing it.
You say that you'd like to transcend the way in which we see and hear and smell, but actually seeing and hearing and smelling is what you do. You do it more intensely than the rest of us, it seems to me, that you're minutely observing yourself and registering your responses to the world around you. Maybe that's the transcendence there. The very thing you're trying to overcome is the very processes in which you are engaged because they're so bodily.
It's odd, isn't it? It's a paradox. I know that that's sort of true, that my writing is very visual, quite sensual in a way, yet there is very little bodily presence in the book. You don't know if I'm tall or short or fat or thin. You can't really picture me unless you know what I actually look like. I don't talk about my body, really. I'm not very interested in it. It's odd, isn't it?
It is odd. I mean, the great paradox about you is that in one way you can come across, Robert, if I can say this, as sort of fussy and pedantic and sort of prissy.
A feat, you're trying to say. A feat.
I was going to say that. Well, I wasn't going to say that, but you've laid it on the table. There it is. It's said. But on the other hand, you're just extremely rude. I mean, you're a very, very rude man.
About everybody or
unexpectedly rude. Suddenly, there you are again being rude or talking about how randy you're feeling. You know, you think, come on, you're 71. You're supposed to be, well, as you say, playing golf and behaving properly.
That's right. But, I mean, those things don't change in you, actually. I mean, you have an erotic connection with the world regardless how old you are. Patrick White certainly did. I mean, you do. And particularly in this world, I think, where we're given erotic stimulation at every step. I don't think that you just sort of turn off because you're 70 or 71. I don't see quite why you should. There are many kinds of love, though, in this book, I feel I should say. What interests me most of all is not the erotic, it's intimacy, which often does not include the erotic. It might include some sort of desire, some vague desire for the erotic, but I'm very interested in intimate friendships, friendships where you really are interested more than in anything else in the world in what your friend, the one that you love, is feeling, what is inside the one that you love. And I feel that intimacy is quite difficult in the modern world. I feel that many of us are living in a virtual world and we're failing to really be curious and to give weight and to think that what matters is what is inside those that we love. And I really want to know what is deep inside those that I love. I really do. And I want them to want to know what's inside me.
Mm. And, well, this book shares what's inside you in a very intimate way. And it occurs to me as I'm talking to you now, Robert, that one of your ways of being in the world is you can present sometime a quite austere exterior.
Really?
Yes, you can be quite sort of formal and formidable.
Really?
Even though you're a person of short stature, you can really look sort of tough.
Yeah. Short stature?
Well, you
really?
Are.
Yes,
you are,
I've shrunk, it's true.
You are tough.
Yes, I see. Yes,
and,
I am quite.
And tough. And then suddenly the doors open. And we're in a place that's very sharing and generous and intimate. But you make a decision about when you're going to open. You're not kind of being, you know, lovey-dovey to the world.
Absolutely not. No, I'm not a lovey-dovey sort of person.
I don't know where that word came from. The other emotion that you talk about in this collection is infatuation.
Yes.
The crush. Yeah, talk to us about that, because you value that. It's still there, the ability to be infatuated, the capacity to be infatuated.
I do like to have a crush at least once every 2 years, yes. I think that the infatuation, the crush, the sudden violent liking of somebody, the wish to draw a little too close, a little too soon to somebody, and it's always lopsided, is one of the great joys of life. in some ways, it can be more memorable than the great love of your life. And I've had, I suppose, two great loves in my life. One a woman, one a man. But the crush stays with you as if it was yesterday. And I keep a list of my crushes in the top drawer of my desk, just to remind myself of them.
I see. Some people put, apparently, marks on their bedpost, but do you have a little list in the...
They're not particularly sexual affairs. Right. They're sort of emotional. They're longings. That terrible longing. And in the old days, of course, it was waiting for the telephone to ring. I don't suppose people do that anymore. But in the days of fixed telephones, you would stay at home. You wouldn't go out the front door in case the phone rang.
But you don't switch your phone off now. It's still there in your pocket. And when it vibrates against your chest, you know that the loved one
is
calling.
Yes, well, the only thing that does vibrate anymore. I actually have a very simple sort of telephone. But I can remember the days when, yes, you couldn't leave the house. I mean, those are wonderful things to live through. Mm. They really are wonderful.
Now, what I want to ask as we wind up is, where is your partner, Peter, in all this? Because
he's the hero of this book.
Yes, but you're writing so intimately about your infatuations and your flirtations with other people. It must be hard on him, is it not?
No, I don't think so. He's a big boy. I say he is the very continuation of who I am. That's the word I use. He is the hero of this book. He is the one without whom I barely exist. But that doesn't mean that he is everything.
Yes, it's full of love for him. There's no doubt about that. As we wind up, it would be good just briefly to get you to share your views about gay marriage, because you make some very barbed observations about gay marriage.
Well, yes, you see, I don't really think it's about equality. I think it's everybody thinking, I would like to have what she's having. And I don't think that they've realised that it would be best to find out what it is she's having, to go back to Harold and Maud, was it? Harold and Sally, without knowing what they are having. I don't think you perhaps want what they're having. I don't think it's about equality. I think it's sentimentality, really. And I think that the important thing is the quality of your life, not the approval of the church or the state.
Robert Desai, it's been wonderful to have you back in Studio 306.
Been wonderful to be here with you. Thank you, Michael.
Robert Desai, his marvellous collection of essays, well, it's a memoir, but his mind drifts from into one essay after another, is called What Days Are For. It's a beautiful little hardback published by, do you say the K? Knopf? Knopf? Knopf?
I never say it.
You never enunciate the name of your publisher.
Never.
It could be Knopf. It could be Knopf. We don't know. We should have found out. Across Australia, this is RN. You're listening to Books and Arts Daily.
Imagine I'm kissing
kissing
you. It might be the last time I'll ever ask you to.
Think of me, dream of me. Why don't you simply need me like I need to?
The Australian pop group Pyrrha with Rose-Coloured Glasses. They're performing at After Dark, which is at the Art Gallery of New South Wales in December. Well, two books have landed on my desk that look at the significance of Australian painting and telling stories. And so let's meet the authors of both of them. Patrick McCackie is a former director of the National Gallery of Victoria. He's published many books on art, and his new one is lovely. It's called Strange Country, Why Australian Painting Matters. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much indeed.
And until recently, Barry Pearce was the head curator of Australian art at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. And his book is called 100 Moments in Australian Painting, and it's lovely. Barry, welcome aboard.
Nice to be here.
Patrick, let's start with you. The subtitle of your book is Why Australian Painting Matters, which suggests that there are some people who believe it doesn't matter. Is that a sense that you have?
Not really. I think what it was that I've been always haunted by this strange experience, and Barry, I think, we've been talking about it too, the way in which, why does Australian painting so often fail when it's shown abroad? And yet when sophisticated people, or not even that sophisticated people, come from America and Europe to Australia, and they see Australian art, they're bowled over by it. And I suppose I had in the back of my mind trying to explain to this audience why it matters, and also, frankly, why it. I think it's good to speak up for painting again, which has been rather in the shadows, and to say to my fellow Australians why Australian painting matters, why it's such an extraordinary phenomenon. A tiny population produces a painting way above its weight and quality.
Barry, you were the head curator of Australian Art at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. Was that your experience? I mean, are there tourists who come to Sydney and then make a beeline for the Art Gallery to see the Aussie art?
Well, my experience of international visitors is that they've always got very excited. I mean, and I worked very hard to make the Australian collection look as good as it could possibly be and maximise its sense of dignity and its energy and its inventiveness. And I always got very, very positive feedback. But as a curator, I was also involved in touring some Australian shows overseas. So I did witness this mixed reaction it's like taking the wine out of the country, thinking it was the greatest wine you've ever tasted, and then it goes to some other country, on the other side of the world, and it doesn't seem to taste so good.
I think that's true of any alcohol. You know, you drink Retsina in Europe, and then you bring it home, and it tastes like turps.
Yes, tastes like kerosene. But I've never been able to really understand that. But I must say, I was involved in a very successful show overseas, which may turn out to be one of the most successful of all. And it's funny that Edmund Capon, in the Sydney Morning Herald back in September, was on this issue because he was presenting a paper in Beijing on Australian culture, saying, you know, overseas people don't like Australian art. That was his proposition, and that the solution was the paradigm of Australian art or contemporary art, which eradicated all sense of being Australian, and that was the key to success. But he has a very short memory, because in 1983 he endorsed a show that we sent to Beijing called Mood and Moment, A Century of Australian Landscape, from John Glover, sort of 1830s through to between the two world wars. And it was actually based on the idea of poetry in the landscape, to sort of synergize with the Chinese idea of poetry in the landscape in their art. And, you know, and I was there for the opening and I gave some talks, you couldn't move. There were something like 1,200 people a day shunting through. It was most extraordinary, over 12 days.
Oh, well, we can take great strength from that, the fact that you can draw an audience.
But the ironic thing is that up to a decade, 2 decades later, and I actually witnessed this, Chinese delegations were coming to Sydney and they were going to see Edmund, saying, we want another one, we want a sequel, because it had such a powerful impact on the audience there. Now, again, I don't know. I can't explain why that was successful and other shows haven't been so successful, but it's not true to say entirely that overseas audiences have been neutral about Australian painting.
Patrick, I have a theory that only Australians can get Sidney Nolan, that if you're from overseas, you will never understand that this is something more than a guy who can't really paint.
I don't think that's very true. Sorry, Michael, because in many ways, Nolan's reception in London in the 1950s, when he settled there in 1952, was absolutely extraordinary. I mean, Brian Robertson gives him a retrospective at the Whitechapel Gallery in 1956 and said, Mr. Marshall painted an awful lot of pictures for that show. And it was the hit of the season. I mean, good God, even Princess Margaret went to it. And it really established Nolan's rare reputation in Britain. And maintained it really for the next 10 years or so. So I really think Nolan is a genuinely universal figure. There would be an argument, a good argument, to say, sure, if you go out into the Australian bush and the Victorian landscape where the Kellys were painted and so on, or the landscape you drew from, it increases and enriches your feeling for Nolan. But I have to say, he really is a kind of universal geist, and who I think his message carries pretty well universally.
Let's step back a bit, because both of you start in the 19th century in your account, and in fact, you have a lot to say about Aboriginal art, Patrick. I wanted to ask you, your book is called Strange Country, Why Australian Painting Matters. I wondered whether you think there is a moment when settler Australians stopped painting like strangers. I mean, if we look at the early paintings, the early Sydney paintings, they do register the strangeness of Australia. They might express affection and optimism. They might express a sense of alienation. But they are painters trying to record something new, to register something that is novel to them. When is the moment when settler Australians stop painting like strangers, do you think?
I actually think it begins with John Glover. I mean, John Glover was a very mediocre British landscape painter before he came. And it's when he arrived at the age of 16, 1830, he suddenly embraces the Tasmanian landscape. The shackles of European conventions, particularly that of Claude, fall from his shoulders and his art. And he paints with a kind of brilliance. I mean, he really knows that there's something about Australian light and the effect it has on the landscape, which is totally unlike Europe. And he becomes the marvellous Australian Glover, whom we all kind of revere and admire. And when you look at the English pictures, they kind of always look that terrible, leaden, porridgey look to them. So I think it begins quite early on in the piece.
And he's actually able to animate that landscape with a sense of spirit, because he fills the Tasmanian landscape with Aborigines, caught kind of a moment before whites had arrived, and plays with the gum trees. You know, that people often say he couldn't paint gum trees, but of course he could. He absolutely understood the sinuous line of the gum tree and had such fun with it, Patrick.
Yes, and he's terrific. His best observation is that the leaves of gum trees hardly cast any shadow at all. And that sort of translucency of the light is a very important part. And Glover looked very closely and got that absolutely right. You are right about the painting of the indigenous people, but he also sometimes has those really shocking moments when he paints one of the great homesteads and the kind of settler landscape, and there's no indigenous people to be seen because they have been shunted off the land in the process of white settlement.
And that's true. I hadn't thought about that. He actually does register erasure, doesn't he?
Absolutely. And they should, in one sense, should make us pause when we look at Glover today.
Mm. Can we jump forward? I just want to keep moving through history here. Just talk briefly, Patrick, about Chapter 4 in your book, which is called The National Enterprise, the 1890s, which I was pleased to see because I always think it's a little ridiculous to talk about the national in Australia much earlier than the 1880s or the 1890s. Can you just tell us a bit about what you think is what's occurring in that period?
Well, I'd love to hear Barry on this point too, because it is extraordinary how we get in the 1890s a series of these kind of major pictorial undertakings, Tom Roberts shearing the rams, fires on at Lapstone Tunnel by Arthur Streeton, the kind of wonderful kind of paintings by McCubbin of Men Out of Work and so on. And for a moment it seems that they want to gather the forces of their art to make larger, bolder claims for the nature of the Australian experience than had been made ever before. This is somehow fully and powerfully representative of the best or the greatest aspirations inside Australian life. And I find it very, very moving. And they all seem to be struck at the same moment in wanting to do this. But I'd love to hear what Barry says about that.
Well, look, I agree with Patrick about John Glover, but I see it as really a miraculous exception, because still up until the 1870s, 80s, there was still this sense of strangers painting the landscape. And to me, the moment when that changed was really the arrival of two Europeans. One was Abraham Louis Bouvelot, who arrived in Melbourne, I think in the 1870s, and then Julian Ashton. And both of them encouraged the local artists to really become more relaxed about falling in love with and painting the intimacies of the bush that were in near reach of the cities. I mean, by then you had train lines going out to places like Templestowe, and you could walk to Templestowe. And so it was actually, and the plein airist philosophy that both of those artists brought with them, that to me was the moment when it changed from the Australian landscape being painted by strangers as to being painted by people who were settled in Australia and were and fell in love with it. They weren't in awe of nature anymore. They recognized its intimacies, and that was the change. Late, sort of early 1880s, and of course we know the Heidelberg School, Patrick's just mentioned, and the wonderful 1890s explosion of nationalist big scale painting of Australian life and landscape. Really, that I think we've hardly created that moment ever since.
I think Louis Bouvelot does blaze the trail, Barry. In fact, he's here in the 1860s, and he's painting Eastern Australia, especially country around Melbourne, but up into New South Wales as well. And he shows the process of colonisation, which is exciting, because you can see the farm laid out before you, but also the process of clearing. In fact, there's one painting, a painting at Heidelberg, where he actually shows a farm alongside a group of people in a forest clearing and burning logs. So the very moments of colonisation, of taking the strangeness of the land and making it ours, of making it knowable in colonial terms, is actually being recorded by him.
Yeah. I think the word is compatibility. That's what Bouvelot bought. And also Ashton. We have to give Ashton a lot of credit, because he went to Melbourne first, and then he moved up to Sydney and became a trustee. And he, in Sydney, of course, was making sure that the Sydney Gallery was buying contemporary paintings by people like Streeton and Roberts.
So. Well, it's, Julian Ashton, I think, is a Sydney taste only. It may be part of their distinction, or it may not be. But on Bouvelot, I agree. I think he was as dull as ditchwater Bouvelot. But I began to see how, in fact, what he picks up is the sheer untidiness of the landscape, the way in which it does not configure easily and neatly. And I rather like that quality in him.
Barry, you've said that Bailed Up, which was painted in 1895 by Tom Roberts, and then he fiddled with it a bit.
1927.
30 years later. You've said it's your favourite painting in the Art Gallery of New South Wales. So this is a country road, a bush road. It's a hold-up of a stagecoach. And it's a very still and placid painting, actually, despite the fact that what's happening in it is potentially very violent.
Well, you know, there's a perverse part of me that doesn't like paintings that come too easily. I like to see a bit of a struggle, and Bailed Up is the exemplar of a painting that been struggled over. I mean, Roberts couldn't sell it. I mean, he couldn't get people interested. They were criticising the anatomy of the horses and the painting of the landscape. And so in 1927, he seemed to recast it completely by scraping it back. And I think he flattened it out and made it more frieze-like in 1927, which actually gave it a little more of a modern look. And my theory is that in 1927... Roberts changed Bailed Up from being a 19th century painting to being a painting of the 20th century. So, but anyway, I adore that painting. I've spent 33 years looking at it almost every day and never got tired of it. It just exudes this wonderful glare and energy that just comes from the light, and this frozen moment, of course, this laconic kind of depiction of a stagecoach robbery.
Michael, I think it's worth pointing out, too, about Bailed Up, that it's a very fecund picture, because it was Roberts who really was the first man to let those trunks of the gum trees in from the top frame. And that resonated enormously with Fred Williams, who based his own painting called My Garden largely on Bailed Up, almost exactly the same size, with that one odd sense of the trees being let in from the top frame and the strange fern life exploding in the lower register of the painting. And he always openly confessed to it that it was his kind of variation on Bailed Up. So it was a very fecund painting for later art.
Patrick, we're just coming to the end of our conversation, but you argue that something pretty fundamental happens to Australian art in the 1960s. What happens that excites you in that period?
I thought about this a great deal. I mean, the reigning interpretation of the 1960s are that a whole new group of younger artists came along, painted flat, hard-edged abstractions derived largely from Anglo-American painting. And that this was really not as good as what had gone on before, which was more original, more distinctively Australian. But the more I looked at it, the more it was that these young Turks brought something new to the table. And painters like Fred Williams, like John Brack, and even like John Olson and Geoffrey Smart paid attention to what the young were doing. And, I mean, Geoffrey Smart, I think, over the 1960s, the early 1970s, he begins to paint in a kind of those wonderful office blocks and balconies on anonymous buildings with a kind of regimentation and rhythm of minimal painting and minimal sculpture. Williams empties out his pictures steadily throughout the 1960s, so he's kind of flat grey grounds on which he makes minimal markings again. They suddenly saw the power of leaving out. and that the minimalist effect of these younger Turks had an effect on them. So now the 1960s seems to me a very exciting time when there's a real dialogue and interaction between generations of Australian painters in a way that I don't think had really ever happened before.
As we wind up, can we talk about Aboriginal art? Because it's the art that's celebrated, and it's the art which a lot of people overseas value or find distinctive about Australian art. They often find the settler art in some ways derivative. Can you talk to me briefly about what you think has been the impact of Australian art in changing the way we think about the art scene and who we are? Patrick?
Well, I think it's been the greatest rare revolution in our times, has been the awareness and acceptance and the enormous support institutionally and privately for contemporary Aboriginal art, starting with Jeff Barton at Papunya in 1970-71. I mean, now we all have a great, deep, profound understanding of what the nature of the dreaming is, what the connection is of individual indigenous people to the dreaming, why they value the land. And it has transformed our vision, too, as to how we see the landscape, how we value it, and I think it's also transformed our view of Indigenous and Aboriginal people. It's been a great artistic and social revolution, and I think the museums of Australia have responded splendidly to it with really great collections.
Can I just add something to that, Michael, though, that the revelation and the revolution actually happened earlier than Papunya Tula. It happened when Charles Mountford went up north with the American, you know, the Americans, and they discovered the culture and the visual culture of Aboriginal art. And through Mountford's influence, a lot of wonderful bark paintings came into public art collections, like particularly Adelaide, I can think of, and in Sydney.
So Mountford, just to explain who Mountford was, I think he was an anthropologist, wasn't he?
That's correct.
In South Australia, and he went up in the 20s or the 30s, between the wars.
But that changed radically everybody's perception of Aboriginal artefacts as being ethnography and anthropology, to that they were works of art, that they could sit comfortably in art
museums. Very optimistic reading of the effect of Charles Mountford. I mean, I agree entirely that he changed institutions' belief from seeing them as ethnographic fragments to being works of art. But it caused nothing like the public understanding and ripple which was happened, I think, by contemporary Aboriginal painting beginning in the 1970s.
Well, of course, the change that's occurred is, I mean, you can have this debate, the two of you, about whether it's anthropological or whether it's art at that stage, but we are in a stage now where Aboriginal art is part of the Australian story. It's not a kind of them or us narrative anymore. We all think of Emily King-Warry as part of our story.
Absolutely right. And that, I think, is a slightly deeper embrace. I mean, I admire Charles Mountford enormously, and he had a big influence on Nolan. He opened one of Sidney Nolan's early exhibitions in Sydney in the 1950s, and he was a great figure. But it still seemed to me that Aboriginal art in the 1950s and through the 1960s was still the domain of the enthusiasts and a very rather small group who really knew and understood it. I remember looking back that in the years that I reviewed Art for the Age, I think between 1966 and 1969, there was exactly one exhibition of Aboriginal art that I could review.
Well, that is a stunning change, isn't it? Absolutely stunning. As we wind up, you've both written books about paintings.
Now, sorry, Michael, but Patrick is leaving out the influence of Tony Tuckson, who worked so hard during the 50s to get the Aboriginal paintings into the collections. And you can't look at someone like Ian Fairweather, who discovered, Aboriginal paintings in the 50s, and look at great masterpieces like Anarkabayan and other paintings of that period without thinking of Aboriginal art. So, you know, I think the profundity was actually being seeded a bit before Papunya Tula.
Well, there's a lovely essay to be explored here about the gradual journey of Aboriginal art into the mainstream of Australian consciousness, I guess. As we wind up, you've both written books about paintings, and there are many people who come into the studio here at Books and Arts Daily and tell us that painting is over. The serious art world has moved on from the oil painting. It's so yesterday. Do you see a future for oil paintings? Are you still excited by them?
The canon still exists. It's just more difficult to find now in the great dispersal of creative energy into the fourth dimension, theatrical kind of art and so forth. But I feel there are painters now who are, when we use the word canon, I think it's a sense of respect that good painters have for what's been done before them, and to carry that and make their own addition to it into the future. And I think it's still there.
Yes, it's like all the kind of talk there used to be about the death of the novel. And my God, the novel still goes on. I mean, painting may no longer have to carry the burden of being the most advanced art around. But that doesn't mean that painting of great quality is not continuing to be made in Australia, particularly by women, I think, at present. And I mean, the two abstract artists whom I'm enormously excited about at work today is Elizabeth Cummings, in going strong in her mid-80s, and Ada Tomescu. And if those artists were set down in New York, they would cause a stir.
Well, I'll leave the two of you to continue your discussions and your disagreements in your own time. We'll have to wind that up.
I agree with that, though. So good on you, Patrick. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. And thank you, Barry, for coming. It has been great to talk. Patrick McKechnie is an eminent art historian and academic, and he's a former director of the National Gallery of Victoria. And his book is called Strange Country, Why Australian Painting Matters. It's published by Melbourne University Press. And Barry Pearce recently retired as the head curator of Australian art at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. And his new book is called 100 Moments in Australian Painting, and that's from the collection, the Australian collection at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart. Now let's meet Joanna Murray-Smith.
Looking for the next big thing in pop music?
A time of peace for all people.
The 90s saw a strange parade of noisy and downright weird bands.
The sound was right, the drugs were right, and suddenly the Happy Mondays nonsense made perfect sense.
Pop revolution or old-fashioned sellout?
So we sold out, big deal.
I really don't know what the definition of selling out is anymore.
Love in the 90s, into the music, Saturday at 4. Now. Cry the long night through. Well, you can cry me a river. Cry me a river. I cried a river over you.
Julie London with Cry Me a River. It's a song that you'll hear in a new show called Pennsylvania Avenue. It opened last night at the Melbourne Theatre Company. I was there, and at the end, the audience were on their feet. They were rapturous. The play was written by the chuckler in our studio, Joanna Murray-Smith. She's on fire. Two shows on at the moment in two big cities.
Ah, yes, I know. It never rains but it pours, and then I'll have nothing on for the rest of my life.
Oh, never mind. Never mind. You can bask in this moment. So you've got Switzerland on in Sydney. You've got a favourite Aussie painting, apropos of what we were just discussing?
I have a lot of favourite Aussie artists. Adore Rick Amore, a wonderful Melbourne artist. But probably my favourite painting is not in Australia, although it is an Australian painting.
Oh, this is such a cosmopolitan answer.
This is a very cosmopolitan answer. When I was living in New York writing Honor, very early play, I lived on the Upper West Side, and Ray and I and our little baby Sam then, who's now 6'1".
Ray being your husband.
Ray being my husband, would walk across Central Park to the Metropolitan and go and stand in front of Fred Williams' Windjana Gorge painting of the Kimberleys, which he did in the 1980s.
What, you'd grab passers-by and say, we're from there.
We did it as a pilgrimage, and because... you know, it was so evocative of home, and we missed home. So I suppose I would say that is my favourite Australian painting.
That's a lovely story. I didn't know what you were going to say. You came up with a real pearler. That was a beauty. There's been a lot of doom and gloom recently about Australian theatre, Australian plays in Australian theatre. You know, we're all the common wisdom is we're telling foreign stories, we're doing adaptations of the classics, and there's no room for Aussie plays. But, oh, well, one of these plays is not very Aussie, but you're an Aussie writer and you're telling stories.
I think Australian plays are plays written by Australians, really. And I think, you know, it's wonderful when Australian writers, playwrights write plays about the Australian experience. But I don't think that means that plays that are set elsewhere or about other things are not reflective of the Australian experience, because we are Australian.
Well, Shakespeare used to set plays all over the place.
Yes.
Sometimes in imaginary places, with names like Illyria.
Well, I remember when a play of mine, Rapture, which was originally at the Malthouse, was being considered for the National in London. And in the end, it didn't go on because the director, who ended up choosing Honor, Roger Michell, said, although this play could be set anywhere in the world, English characters would not talk about spirituality so openly. And I thought, well, there you go. You know, that was an example of a play that was not set in Australia, but it was expressive in some ways of the Australian openness or loquaciousness.
Loquaciousness. Mm. That's a lovely word to wheel out. So let's, oh, gosh, it's going to get away from us this time. Let's talk about Switzerland, the Sydney show. Just briefly, what's that about?
Switzerland is an imagined final 3 days in the life of a real writer, Patricia Highsmith, who your listeners may know from The Talented Mr. Ripley or the Ripley books, which were kind of diabolically dark crime novels.
They'll all know that because they're very smart, the listeners.
Because they're
program.
Very smart. And also she wrote Strangers on a Train, which Hitchcock, of course, made into a film. And she was a horrible, difficult, mean, nasty, misanthropic.
Is she still alive?
No.
Oh, thank goodness for that. Off you go. Say what you like.
I had to, yes, put my house in my somebody else's name before I came on the show. A very, very difficult woman, but perhaps the writer with the most psychological insight of any English language writers of the 20th century. She had an amazing understanding of the dark side of human nature, human motivations. And she was also, in her defense, incredibly clever and very wonderful writer, but also very funny, very acerbic, and very charismatic. And so the divine Sarah Pierce plays her in Switzerland, which is at the Opera House, and opposite her is a young man called Eamon Farron, who plays a young man who is sent from her publishing house in New York to persuade her to write a final Ripley. But the play is, in many ways, it is a thriller. It's about what happens. As Patricia says in the play, if you put two people in a room and you let their true selves come out, chances are only one's going to survive. And it is kind of about what happens between them, but it is also about the nature of how writers fall in love with their own creations.
Does it have any common ground with The Female of the Species, in which a character not unlike Germaine Greer gets bailed up by a stranger who comes into her house?
Well, it's much, much darker than that play. I mean, it really is a thriller, and it's kind of been ingeniously designed, both the sound, Steve Francis, Nick Schlieper's lighting and Michael Scott Mitchell's set are all very kind of noirish. So it's all shadows and light and flickering fires and very sort of Broadway-esque set. So it's a much darker play than Female. But, there are certain similarities between the two female characters.
Was there some unfinished business that you had with the last show? I mean, was there something you thought, now there's something I worked with in The Female of the Species which I'd like to return to and treat in a little bit differently or go a little bit further with?
Not really, because this play is really an investigation into the power of the imagination in a writer's life, how they are kind of transfixed by the world of their own imagining. So it's about how Patricia Highsmith really fell in love with Ripley and in fact wanted to be Ripley. So it's a kind of very strange and I hope interesting kind of psychological investigation, but it is funny, as Female of the Species was.
Well, Peter Craven, who's one of the most perceptive reviewers in the country, I reckon, said it was by far and away the best thing you'd ever written.
Well, that's very nice of him. Of course, you always love, you know, your most unloved children the best. So, so I'm not going to...
Oh, you're burying a candle for some classic you wrote that's underappreciable.
Yes, or in a bottom drawer.
We might talk about what that is another day. Maybe we should do a segment on bottom drawers and get a lot of people to come in with the work they know is their best thing but was never appreciated. Are you putting your hand up for that, Joanna?
I am.
And then
I am.
We can...
I'm here.
Okay, well, she's on board. Let's try and get a few other people to sign up for that one. Very briefly, as it turns out, let's talk about Pennsylvania Avenue, which I saw last night at the Melbourne Theatre Company. In a, It stars the amazing Bernadette Robinson, who's amazing at singing, amazing because she can sing like other people. Here she is, not from your show, this is a recording made almost a decade ago, where she's singing a song, a Cher song, as if it were sung by Julie Andrews.
If I could turn back time, and if I could find a way, I'd take back those words that hurt you, and you'd stay. I don't know why I said the things that I said.
You see, she sounds just like Julie Andrews singing a Cher song. It's creepy. So basically, we've got a woman called Harper Clemens, who you've made up, who's in the White House for, is it 30 years, and yes, sees the parade of history through the blue room.
That's right. She's there for 7 administrations. She comes in as a young girl from Thunderbolt, Georgia, a small town in Georgia where she is surviving a traumatic event. And she goes to the White House in her first job in a way to get away from Thunderbolt, Georgia. And she stays over 7 or 8 administrations, but never particularly gets high in rank. She's happy to be one small cog in the machine of modern democracy as she sees it.
Now, it's quite an ambitious play because, unlike the last show that you did with this team, in which what you simply did was have Bernadette talk to a series of famous singers, in this one she's actually commenting not just on the famous singers who've been through the White House and impersonating them, but talking about the presidents and the president's wives and the other important people who've been there. Mm. So it's quite a complex and ambitious task you've set yourself in this one.
Yes, I mean, I think the challenge was in Songs for Nobodies, which was very successful. In that play, Bernadette sang with gusto and brilliance and felt, but the acting was only, it was kind of determined by the fact that it was vignettes.
Yeah.
And so in this, we kind of wanted to push her. So not only does she do many, many more voices, presidents, colleagues at the White House, and many more singers, and singers that she doesn't do normally in her repertoire, but she also has to hold a character for an entire 90 minutes, an invented character. And so she has to do a lot of acting as well. And as usual with Bernadette, she says, I can't. And then she does. And she gets standing ovations. And that's what happened with Songs. And that seems to be what's happening with Pennsylvania Avenue. I guess I was interested in the idea of telling a story, a personal story, but through the prism of someone who is living life in part in response to world events, as someone in the White House does. And the trick to the play really was about allowing world events that she had one small part in to resonate with her personal story.
And the wonderful thing about the play is, even if you get lost in the personal story, she's always going to come on and sing another marvellous song.
She is. I mean, I have tingles every time she does Eartha Kitt. I just think her Eartha Kitt is quite incredible. Yeah. But she's, you know, she's can apply herself to pretty much any voice. You know, when I first said to her, look, I really think we should end the show with Aretha Franklin, she said, no, Joe, I can't do that. I can't do that. I can't do that voice. And then
Turns out she can.
Yeah.
Thank you, Joe. Joanna Murray-Smith, her play is called, oh, well, one of them is called Pennsylvania Avenue. That's the one in Melbourne. That's running until the 20th of December. And Switzerland is on at the Sydney Theatre Company. That's also on until the 20th of December. And Bernadette Robinson will be talking about Pennsylvania Avenue on the music show on Saturday. That's tomorrow. And she'll be singing a couple of songs too. So there you go. That's the program for today. Don't forget the European Classics Book Club for this month. We're reading The Name of the Rose. We're discussing it on the final Friday of the month, so this is a good weekend to get stuck in. The Subcontinent Book Club list for next year, 2015, is up. You have voted. We have decided. Well, we've taken your decisions. So go out and grab those books. Start reading them. The ABC Bookshop's going to be stocking them, so that might be something to get for Christmas, all those Indian books. Give them to your friends and then borrow them back and read them for the book club. Thanks to the team. You've been marvellous as always. Rhiannon Brown's the executive producer. The producers are Georgia Moody, Kate Evans, Sarah Lestrange, Suzanne Donisthorpe, Anita Barrow, Doug Spencer, Anita Frey-Taylor. Our technical operator today is Kerry Dell. Lots of arts on the show, on RN, sorry, over the weekend, including Books Plus with Kate Evans on Sunday at 2. But now we're coming up to Bush Telly. Cam, what's happening?
Thunderbolt George is a real place, Michael. I had no idea.
Well, there you go. Real place.
Yeah, small town, 2,500 people. Today we're looking at why exercise feels easier in the outdoors.
Does it?
Yeah, yeah, this has been proven.
What, easier than in your bedroom?
Easier than, say, on a treadmill. If you go for a run, if you go for a run in a park, it's easier. It feels easier than if you run on a treadmill. It's all about the health benefits of national parks. Stay with us.
Good Lord. The things you learn on Radio National. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is RN. I'll talk to you on Monday. Bye-bye.